Chalmers was sleeping in his brother-in-law's home on New Year's Eve of 1884. It was particularly cold that evening in Austin, Texas, with newspapers even reporting on a cowboy that had frozen to death overnight. Chalmers, the tough former Texas Ranger, was nice and cozy in his bed when the knocking began. He didn't care. He was warm and not about to get up. But then the knocking continued, followed by a cry for help. Still didn't care. Chalmers once broke all his teeth after being flung from a horse. He spit his teeth out, climbed back on, and kept riding. The knocking was getting annoying, and the next "help me" came as a shout. Still, Chalmers snoozed away until he heard the front door open. Chalmers finally stepped out of bed and ambled down the hallway. He saw the figure of a black man wobbling across the wooden floor. Chalmers, lighting a match to see the man, recognized him as Walter Spencer, a boyfriend of the home's domestic servant. "Mr. Tom, Mr. Tom," Spencer cried out to Chalmers. "For God's sake, do something to help me. Somebody has nearly killed me." Chalmers did not care about this news so much as he cared about the amount of blood pouring from the gash on the man's head and onto his brother-in-law's floors. Spencer told Chalmers that someone must have attacked him in his sleep, for he woke with a terrible head wound and his girlfriend Molly was missing. She had been sleeping next to him, but now she was nowhere to be found. Again, Chalmers wondered why he ought to care about such a thing, even as the man he was speaking to was swaying under the agony of his injury. Spencer had ceased caring about his own wounds, though, and continued to explain how he searched both yards and even looked up and down the street for Molly. "Mr. Tom, please!" Spencer begged Chalmers for help finding her as the blood dribbled down his face and into his mouth. Tom Chalmers knew exactly what to do. He instructed Spencer to go wrap a bandage around his head lest he bleed to death, and then Chalmers kicked him out of the house, mopped up the blood, and then went back to bed. The next morning, Molly's body was discovered with an axe wound to the head and stab wounds covering her torso and limbs. Molly Smith was the first murder in a year-long spree that terrorized Austin. 5 other servant girls, just like Molly Smith, would be murdered in the coming months. Like Molly and her boyfriend Walter Spencer, no one would care too much about these murders until Christmas Eve of 1885, when 2 more victims were killed in a single night. And these victims happened to be white women. And then, hell broke loose. I'm your host, Elise, and this is the historical true crime podcast, Old Blood. Austin, Texas, in 1884, believed they were on the verge of a golden era. Their massive red granite state capitol building was in the process of being built. When completed, it would be larger than the capitol in D.C. and dubbed the 7th largest building in the world. There were also opera houses and ice cream parlors, along with ritzy new hotels for all the new visitors. The Driscoll Hotel, for instance, which was purchased in 1884 and finished 2 years later, was one of the few hotels at the time to offer en-suite bathrooms for those staying in the hotel's corner suites. While in the 1860s, Austin had a population of less than 5,000, by 1884 it was 23,000, and compared to the rest of Texas, Austin had an active African-American community. By the time the killings began, Austin's black population was about 3,500, or about 20%. According to Skip Hollinsworth, whose book The Midnight Assassin is a source for this episode, Austin was relatively accommodating to its black residents compared to the rest of the state. Hollinsworth notes the three state-funded schools that recently opened for black students. Some white store owners were starting to allow blacks to shop in their stores, and some saloons carved out black-only sections. Charles Millett of the Millett Opera House welcomed them into his upper balconies, though never for operas because he claimed that the sophistication of it all would just go over their heads. Notice my overuse of the word some, because while some white residents were accommodating to black neighbors, they were in the minority and the level of accommodation was slight. And even the accommodating citizens would not dare to propose such a thing as equal rights. Which was why it was not too unusual when Tom Chalmers saw Walter Spencer bleeding from the head, saying someone was trying to kill him, and he kicked him out before helping him out. Tom Chalmers did not see why he, a white man, should get up from his comfy bed to go look for Spencer's black girlfriend. In his opinion, that was someone else's problem. Molly Smith was born in Virginia in 1857 and was 25 years old when she was murdered. She was described as a, quote, light-colored mulatto, end quote, and worked as a cook/servant for the Rogers family. Molly had a temper, allegedly, and once nearly killed a man with a bottle because of it. She had one child named George, who was the son of her employer's son. And since George was part Rogers, he stayed with the family rather than sleeping with his mother on the night she was killed. Unbeknownst to Tom Chalmers, Walter Spencer left the house and visited Dr. Steiner, who bandaged his head. Spencer then continued to walk the streets. He stumbled around town with a head wound until morning, looking for her. Molly was found just after daylight. A black man was walking in an alley behind the homes when he saw what looked like a dead animal behind an outhouse. But then he got closer and noticed the tattered edges of a nightdress, then legs, and then the man began hollering. Inside, Tom Chalmers heard the yelling and finally decided to go out and look, along with Dr. Steiner, who also came to see. Upon seeing Molly's body, the doctor called for the police. They found Molly lying on her back, with her head split open and multiple stab wounds that were deep enough to expose her organs. Hollinsworth says, quote, blood was everywhere. Bright red lung blood and nearly black gut blood. So much blood was around her, filling up the ruts in the alley, that she seemed to be floating in a pool of it. End quote. When an officer arrived, the men led him through the servants' quarters where Molly lived. The room was trashed. The mirror was shattered and all the bedding was soaked in blood, so much so that it dripped to the floor in a massive crimson puddle. At the foot of the bed rested an axe, dripping with blood. Blood and bloody finger marks led the way Molly had been dragged from her bed to the backyard, and then all the way to the outhouse where her corpse was discovered. At the time, there were 12 police officers in Austin, and not a single one of them were aware of serial killers or how to conduct a homicide investigation. The term serial killer had not yet even been invented, and the men on the force who were used to dealing with criminals were more used to bandits and barroom fights than the murder of an innocent woman. Like Sergeant Cheneville, affectionately known to Austinites as Ronnie O'Johnny. Ronnie O'Johnny fought for the Confederacy in the Civil War and then moved to Austin where he became a police officer. He was a big and scary man, known for easily breaking up barroom fights and the like. He was a typical old-school officer of the law, and he had with him two bloodhounds that would help his investigations. The bloodhounds found nothing, though, and as tough of a criminal catcher Ronnie O'Johnny was, he was no detective. The incident was declared a, quote, Negro killing, end quote, by the papers, and then quickly dismissed as just another case of a black man killing his girlfriend out of jealousy. One newspaper printed, Bloody work, a fearful midnight murder on West Pecan. Mystery and crime, a colored woman killed outright, and her lover almost done for. Several weeks after Molly's murder, a girl woke to see what she thought was a ghost staring at her and demanding either her money or her life. When she screamed, the intruder hit her over the head and fled. Several days after that, a black cook woke to her door shaking. When she opened it to see what was going on, someone grabbed her. She began screaming, and the man fled. 2 days after that, another servant girl was assaulted by a fleeing intruder. Mid-March, two Swedish immigrants were attacked at home, but also escaped with their lives. The man fled. The Daily Statesman printed the headline, Bad Blacks, and continued to explain how it seemed as though there were a gang of black men prowling the city late at night. Despite Walter Spencer's own wounds and his frantically searching for Molly the entire night she was killed, a grand jury voted to indict him for Molly's murder. The district attorney was claiming that Spencer killed Molly after finding she was unfaithful to him. There was no evidence of this. In fact, those who knew the couple said they were happy together, at least just before she was killed. But Austin was supposed to be a safe place. Safe, and in their glory days. They wanted to catch the killer, serve him justice, and move on. But much as Austin wanted to move on, they could not rewrite the facts of the case, and the jury found no reason to convict Spencer. 5 months had passed since Molly Smith was killed, and though her boyfriend was acquitted and no other viable suspects caught, everyone just assumed that it was a singular, terrible episode in their city's history. In truth, it was only the beginning. Thirty-one-year-old Eliza Shelley worked as a servant for Dr. Lucien Johnson, a former state legislator and doctor. She was described as, quote, an excellent woman, end quote. Her husband was in the penitentiary for horse theft, but she still had her daughters and three boys, who lived with her in her servants' quarters on Dr. Johnson's property. And on the evening of May 6th, she climbed into bed with her two youngest boys by her side, and her eldest at the foot of the bed. Early the next morning, Dr. Johnson's wife began to hear Eliza Shelley's children screaming. She wondered what could be wrong and sent her niece to go see what was the matter. It did not take long before her niece, too, was screaming and running back to her. When the doctor returned home soon after, he walked out to the cabin to see for himself. Eliza's three boys were hugging each other in the corner of the room. Eliza herself was on the floor by the bed, wrapped in a bloody quilt. The doctor examined her closer and found an axe wound to the side of her head, along with multiple knife wounds, and a small hole between her eyes, where it appeared as though some sort of a rod had been inserted. There was a similar hole in her temple. Ronnie O'Johnny soon arrived on scene, and though they had spotted footprints that led to the back alley, his bloodhounds couldn't catch a scent. When he spoke to Eliza's boys, the eldest told that he remembered being woken up by a man with a white rag over his face and two holes cut out for the eyes. The boy said he looked white, but he wasn't completely sure. The killer asked the boy if he knew where his mom kept her money, but the boy didn't know, so the man instructed him to put a pillow over his head and not look. If he looked, he would kill him. The boy did as he was told and eventually fell back asleep. He awoke next to his two brothers in the morning, saw their mother lying dead on the floor, and then began screaming. Austin's Daily Statesman called the killing, quote, "another deed of deviltry in the crimson catalog of crime," end quote. And after two black servant girls were brutally murdered in their own quarters, Austin's black population grew, understandably, nervous. Some of the elderly who still practiced hoodoo began creating tonics and mojo bags to keep them and their loved ones safe. Others scattered special powders around doors to deter the evil eye that had come to Austin. Several men were rounded up off the streets and taken in for questioning, including a man who was just in the area and had no shoes. They could find no reason for someone to murder Eliza Shelley. She had no enemies nor money to even steal, and she was patiently waiting for her husband to return from the penitentiary. Then, on May 22nd, only several weeks after Eliza Shelley's murder, the killer struck again. A shoemaker was at home with his family when he began to hear moans that turned to a scream coming from his backyard. The man and his family ran out to the yard to find another black servant girl who had been attacked. It was Irene Cross, who lay on the ground struggling to speak, but blood trickled from her head wound and into her mouth. Her right arm was nearly severed, and it appeared as though someone tried to scalp her. There was a gash that ran halfway around her head. Irene was dazed and unintelligible when someone spoke up and asked her, "Who was it? Who did this to you?" She suffered for several days before dying on May 25th, 1885. The shoemaker had been much more of a decent person than Tom Chalmers, and carried Irene Cross inside and onto one of his beds where she eventually died. Ronnie O'Johnny arrived with his bloodhounds, and for the third time in a row, found nothing. The inquest into her death also came to no conclusion, finding that she had been murdered by persons unknown. Irene's 12-year-old nephew had been in her cabin when the attack occurred. He told police that he saw a shadowy figure sneak into the room holding a knife. He told the boy to stay quiet, that he wasn't there to harm him, before walking into his aunt's bedroom. The man was in there only several minutes before he ran outside. Irene's nephew described him as a, quote, "big chunky Negro," end quote, with bare feet and rolled up pants. Meanwhile, the city had begun to panic. People began to fear for their safety, and with so many people out looking for the murderer, most other crimes dropped significantly. No criminals wanted to be accidentally swept into a murder investigation. Plus, people were starting to get so antsy that they were sticking shotgun barrels out of windows and just randomly firing away whenever they saw a shady person out by an alley or servant's cabin. The town marshal, an ineffective little rich boy who was named Grooms Lee, assured Austin that he was doing his best, but that he desperately needed more officers to help in the search. The problem was that Austin was beginning to see Marshal Grooms Lee as the problem, rather than a lack of manpower. This situation was made even worse when he slept in on the morning that the next servant girl was found murdered. He arrived on scene about 7 hours late. It's unclear if anyone had even called or told Grooms Lee about the murder, according to Hollinsworth, who says the marshal merely looked around for a bit and then left, seeing that he clearly was not needed. Mary Ramey was the youngest of the victims at only 11 years old. She was born in Austin in 1875 and was raised by her mom after her dad left them. She came from a good family. According to Hollinsworth, her uncle had one of the first African-American businesses in Austin, the Carrington Grocery Store, located on East Pecan Street, now 6th. Mary was the baby of the family and the neighborhood. Everyone felt protective of her, particularly as she began attending an all-black grammar school and hoped to enroll in a nearby college after graduating so that she could become a teacher. In the afternoons, Mary Ramey began work as a domestic servant for the white businessman Valentine Weed, who lived only a block away from where Eliza Shelley was murdered. Mary and her mom Rebecca both worked for Mr. Weed, and both were so afraid of the recent attacks that they had stopped sleeping in their own beds in favor for a pallet set out for them in the Weed's kitchen. While they were sleeping, the killer crept through the yard and onto the back porch. He entered the kitchen with a makeshift club in his hand, buckskin filled with lead and sand attached to a strap that he wrapped around his wrist. Mary's mom, Rebecca, about 40 years old and 200 pounds, started to wake. She opened her eyes in time to see the figure of a man just before he bashed his weapon onto her skull, knocking her unconscious. When Rebecca woke some time later, she began moaning and groaning loudly enough that Valentine Weed heard and came down to check on her. He found her crawling on hands and knees like an animal, with blood pouring from her head. Her jaw looked dislocated and her forehead caved in. All she could muster was, "I'm sick." Weed asked about Mary, but could get no response. It was then that he saw the club lying on the floor. Weed grabbed his shotgun and yelled for his neighbor to join him. When they found little Mary, she was still alive, her eyes still partly open. Blood bubbled from her nose and her ears. The more breath she took, the more blood escaped her body. Weed asked his neighbor to guard Mary and the crime scene, and then ran for a doctor, then Ronnie O'Johnny. The doctor knew he could do nothing for Mary other than cradle her head and soothe her as she took her last breath. A long iron rod had been inserted into both of Mary's ears and then pushed into her brain, which doctors said was the cause of her death, though she had also been hit on the head before her killer dragged her outside to rape and kill her. Ronnie O'Johnny's bloodhounds got to work, and this time tracked down a suspect. Sort of. The man was Tom Allen, also known as River Bottom Tom. This episode has some of the best nicknames, I swear. The bloodhounds sniffed at some of the bare footprints found in the alley, and tracked them to River Bottom Tom, who was sleeping shoeless in a hayloft. The dog tore into his arms and legs before Ronnie O'Johnny pulled them off and arrested him. And yet, no blood was found on Riverbottom Tom or his hayloft and belongings. He lived in the area and often walked that alley. Of course, his footprints would be there. But Ronnie O'Johnny had another lead, a, quote, "very impudent Negro," end quote, and a reported thief with a history of fighting. Alex Mack. Well, Mack was not well liked by white Austinites because he had once said fuck you and drank some water from a whites only water bucket. When they found Alex Mack, he had asafoetida, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, on his feet and legs. This was a type of spice used in hoodoo known as devil's dung and was thought to repel evil. Officials were appalled at this hoodoo and argued only a guilty man would cover himself with such a thing. But Alex Mack said he was just using it so that the damn bloodhounds wouldn't smell his tracks and bite him. Finally, with this fourth murder, Austinites were now starting to take notice. While the sexton at the cemetery refused to admit that Molly Smith, Eliza Shelley, and Irene Cross had been murdered and marked their cause of death as head wound or something of the sort, now he finally wrote down murder as Mary Ramey was buried in the colored section of the cemetery. And now the city's aldermen had finally agreed to hire private detectives to help with the investigation. They were understaffed and knew nothing of homicide investigations, so they decided to hire the Noble Detective Agency. The detectives arrived, made some inquiries, and then left for a short vacation just before the next attacks. On September 27th, W.B. Dunham began hearing noises coming from his servants' quarters. Despite the recent attacks in Austin, the noises were like a slapping sound, and the man assumed that it was just his servant girl being whipped by her boyfriend again. Because that was a totally fine and normal thing to hear then. Sarcasm. His cook was Gracie Vance, and she lived with her boyfriend Orange Washington. Orange engaged in the occasional act of domestic violence by whipping Gracie, so Dunham assumed that's what it was and he went back to sleep. But then he heard a groan. Dunham grabbed his pistol and walked outside to see not Gracie or Orange, but their friend Lucinda Bobby, who, Hollinsworth says, was staggering toward him with blood pouring from her head, calling out to him, "Mr. Dunham! We are all dead!" He had her lie down on the back porch and greeted a neighbor who had also heard the shouts and had called the police. This time, the servant girl killer, or the servant girl annihilator, as was coined by Austin's poet, O. Henry, had either decided on or stumbled into a cabin of not just one servant girl, but four fully grown people. Gracie, Orange, and two other servants who were too afraid to sleep alone, that they began sleeping with their friend Gracie. Inside the cabin, Dunham and his neighbor found Patsy Gibson with a crown of blood clinging to life. Orange was face down on the floor, pressed into the lake of blood that surrounded his body. Beside him, a bloody axe. But where was Gracie? Ronnie O'Johnny and a fellow officer galloped up on their horses, dismounted, and set to following the trail of blood that led from Dunham's yard, over the fence, and into their neighbor's backyard. The men were walking towards a stable when they stumbled over Gracie's body. They held their lanterns over her face, but she was unrecognizable. She had been beaten to a pulp with what was likely the brick that lay beside her, also covered in blood. On her wrist, wrapped in a dainty silver chain, was a silver watch, free of any blood. When a woman began hollering from an upstairs window that she saw a man running down the alley toward a seedier area of town, Ronnie O'Johnny and the officers started firing their guns down the alley, hoping to hit him, but really not knowing because it was pitch black. When a local doctor arrived on scene, he declared that the two visitors, Patsy and Lucinda, still alive, had been hit on the head with the flat side of the axe. Orange had been hit in the head twice. Gracie was carried inside the home, where the doctor found she had been hit in the face with a brick a dozen times, as well as being axed in the head. Ronnie O'Johnny and his team stumbled into Gracie's cabin and tried to piece together what happened in there. They thought it likely that someone snuck in and quietly hit them all over the head with an axe, possibly having to hit Orange twice to stop his struggling. Then he must have grabbed Gracie, hauled her over the 4-foot-high back fence, and dragged her into the neighbor's yard. It must have been fast, 5-10 minutes tops. Again, a man named Doc Woods was arrested based upon rumors that he had been angry that Gracie turned him down for Orange. He said he was at home all night, but when an officer saw blood on the bottom of his shirt, they arrested him. It was only hours before they realized he probably wasn't the killer. The doctor examining Doc Woods found that the blood on his shirt was from an open venereal disease. Of course, the whole city had already decided they wanted to lynch Doc Woods before this even came out. Ultimately, Doc Woods had an alibi. Multiple people had seen him elsewhere that night. The Fort Worth Daily Gazette spoke too soon, though, declaring Doc Woods, quote, without doubt the right man, end quote. Police received a visit from Austin resident John Robinson. Robinson told him that his Swedish servant girl was staying in the main house since the murders started, and only went back to her own rooms when she needed to get dressed. Robinson said that in the morning she went to change and found all of her clothes tossed around and her trunk rifled through. She said that only one thing was missing, a silver watch that her dad gave her back in Sweden. An officer grabbed the watch found on Gracie and showed it to her. The girl gasped and said it was hers. Why would someone steal a watch from this girl and then surprise four sleeping adults, kill two of them, and then wrap the watch around the female victim you had just beaten with a brick and axed in the head? Though the other two women, Lucinda and Patsy, had survived the attacks that night, they were likely victims of his anyway. Hollinsworth speculates that they were probably both taken to a county poor farm, since they could no longer work or care for themselves. He says they likely died soon after arriving there for lack of medical treatment. Austin was in turmoil. They were afraid and angry, wanting people to blame for this loss of security and hopefulness. None of the arrests were panning out. Austin's white residents were upset, not so much at the loss of several servant girls, which they were referred to as, but upset that anarchy had come to their great city and their officials were failing to do their jobs. People cried for a replacement for Marshall Groomsley, who was probably fine just hanging out in a saloon somewhere anyway. Mayor Robertson urged everyone to vote for Texas Ranger James Lucy as Groomsley's replacement. And they listened. When the next attack occurred, it would be under Marshal Lucy's watch. Lucy and Ronnie O'Johnny were patrolling the city on Christmas Eve when a man came galloping up to them on horseback, shouting, "A woman has been chopped to pieces!" Groomsley might have counted himself lucky that he wasn't responsible for the city's safety on this particular evening, because on this particular evening, hell broke loose when it became known that the victim was Susan Hancock. A white woman had been murdered, and now everyone really lost their shit. Susan Hancock was born in Alabama in 1840 and later moved to Austin, where she lived with her husband, Moses Hancock, a carpenter. By 1885, Susan was 43 years old, with two daughters, and was known as, quote, one of the most refined ladies in Austin, end quote. On Christmas Eve day, Susan had gone shopping downtown and then went to a Christmas party with her daughters later in the evening. The Hancock daughters stayed late at the party, but Susan returned home to have some cake and read in front of the fire with her husband. They went to bed in their adjoining bedrooms around 10, and their daughters safely returned about an hour later. It was about midnight when Moses woke to noises coming from Susan's bedroom, just across from him. Her room looked ransacked and all of her bedsheets were tossed on the floor. He ran to the open window and noticed blood along the sill. Moses went out to the backyard and found Susan lying on the ground. He bent to look at her just as he saw a shadow in the corner of his eye. The figure jumped over the fence and ran down the alley, so Moses picked up a rock and threw at him, yelling. Hancock's neighbor heard and came running, and the two lifted Susan and carried her into the home. Soon, the mayor, the district attorney, everyone in Austin of significance was at the Hancock home. The teenage son of a doctor found the axe used on Susan just outside of her window, and he picked it up and waved it around to show to people. Moses Hancock looked at it and declared that it was his, that he kept it on a woodpile by the back fence. Ronnie O'Johnny and his bloodhounds arrived, and again found nothing. When the officers entered the home to examine Susan and Moses, they found Moses still in his long underwear, which was smeared with his wife's blood. And on a quilt on the parlor floor was Susan, with two axe wounds to her face. The axe dug into her brain between her left eye and left ear, and the second axe wound was on her cheekbone. Just like with the other girls, Susan's ear and brain had been pierced by some sort of long rod. Susan was still breathing, though. The Daily Statesman reporter who was on scene observed cupfuls of blood pouring from her mouth. Doctors bandaged her wounds to try and stop the bleeding, but there was not much they could do. They tried administering morphine and giving her a little brandy, but she couldn't swallow. Officers were combing through the yard with their lanterns, looking for evidence, when a man on horseback came thundering straight toward them. It was the police department's night clerk, and he was shouting at Marshal Lucy that another woman had been found only two blocks from City Hall. The men were dumbfounded. They weren't even done looking at Susan's attack, and now there was another murder in one night? The night clerk shouted even more disconcerting news. "It's Eula Phillips," he yelled. "Her head's been chopped in two." This only made the men even more confused. Eula was 17, and the wife of a well-known Austin architect. Hell, one of her grandfathers had been part of Stephen Austin's original colony. She was one of the city's most beautiful young girls, and was always seen in the most stylish clothes and feathered hats, which she paraded up Congress Avenue. And now her head was chopped in two? "It's Eula! She's in the Phillips' backyard!" And at that, all the men bolted for the home of Jimmy Phillips. The marshal was led to an outhouse in the yard, where Eula lay with curlers still in her hair, but her nightgown pulled up to her neck. A single axe wound had cleaved into her skull, just above her nose, splitting her forehead in two. There was another wound across the side of her head, though this one ran horizontal. Unlike at all the other scenes, Eula's body had been weighted down with pieces of firewood, one across her stomach, and two more held down her arms, which were outstretched. Officers thought the nightgown was wrapped around her neck because the killer had used it to drag Eula's body outside and across the yard. Her husband, Jimmy, had also been wounded, hit by an axe and was wobbling around with a gash above his ear, unable to talk with anyone, so his mom explained what happened. It was about 12:15 when she began to hear her grandchild Tommy crying. She didn't understand why Eula wasn't taking care of the child, so she went down to check on him. She found little Tommy sitting up in bed, holding an apple in his hand and crying over his father's bloody body. Eula was gone. She then went running to her own husband, who ran down to search and call for help. An axe was found by the bed and was identified as belonging to Jimmy Phillips' father. He kept it by the woodpile behind the house. As Jimmy was becoming more conscious, he turned to ask the doctor, "Where's Eula?" The doctor didn't want to tell him that Eula was dead, because he didn't want him going into shock and dying. Meanwhile, Eula's body was wrapped in a blanket and taken inside the home. The one piece of evidence that would prove crucial to the investigation was found on the hallway outside the Phillips' bedroom. Bloody footprints. Marshal Lucy ordered them cut out, just as they did at Mary Emsley's murder scene, and preserved to test against the suspect's feet. This was especially significant as one of the footprints showed that the murderer had some peculiar feat. It seemed like one of his feet was missing a pinky toe. People were rounded up and ordered to stick their feet into bowls of ink to make an impression that would be compared to the footprint of blood. Word traveled fast, and before long, most Austinites were awake and discussing the Christmas Eve attacks. One reporter wrote that, quote, "The entire population is in the streets, excitedly conversing," end quote. Another wrote that, "People tonight are bordering on a state of frenzy." At 3 a.m, citizens were still pouring into downtown to hear the latest news. Christmas had essentially been canceled. Not even the churches were holding their regular services the following day, particularly as newspaper headlines screamed, "Blood, blood, blood. The demons have transferred their thirst for blood to white people." Gun shops were selling out and had long lines around the corner. People were even pulling out their old firearms from the Texas Revolution to defend themselves. Another paper accurately reported, "Hell broke loose," to explain the Christmas Eve attacks. On Christmas Day, over 500 residents and city leaders met to discuss the attacks. Some citizens had begun to petition the mayor to allow for lynch law, at least until the murderer was apprehended and the attack ceased. Everyone agreed on a citizens' committee of safety instead, luckily. And now Marshal Lucy was finally allowed to hire 20 more officers. There were rewards offered, $300 by Texas's governor, and another $3,000 by prominent Austin businessmen. But these rewards were going unclaimed. Governor Ireland suggested things like everyone pulling their fire alarms when they heard another attack, so that everyone could go running out with their weapons to catch the killer. Others said it would be more sensible to install massive lamps around the city so that so much of it was not hidden in shadow every night. A former Confederate general said, "Screw that, shut down the city and post sentinels at every entrance to thoroughly check everyone who comes and goes." The Noble Detective Agency had clearly not panned out for the city of Austin, so the mayor eventually ended up hiring the famed Pinkerton Detective Agency. The problem was that he didn't do it himself, he had someone do it for him, and the guy wrote out a letter to a Matt Pinkerton in Chicago. His Pinkerton Agency, the other Pinkertons, had no relation whatsoever to the real investigative company. Matt Pinkerton was a night watchman for a hot minute before being fired for incompetence. But of course, if you are fired for incompetence, it's clearly a sign that you're actually brilliant and should start your own company. So that's what Matt Pinkerton did. And he actually did cash in on money from those who had confused his business with the real Pinkertons. The mayor did not yet know he hired the Fakertons, which is what I will be calling the fake Pinkerton company. In fact, the mayor kept it a secret after he found out because he was so embarrassed at his error and at wasting so much taxpayer money during such a difficult time. Needless to say, the Fakertons did not uncover much. Ever since the killing started, people have debated whether there was just one murderer or several. At a time when the term serial killer did not yet exist, local law enforcement was in the dark as to how to apprehend such a monster. PBS did a documentary about the Servant Girl Annihilator back in 2014, and they had on FBI criminal profiler Mark Safarik, who outlined his reasons for why he believed the killer acted solo. Besides the fact that only one man was ever seen leaving the scenes, the fact that he had to drag the women across the ground to the location where he killed them is a sign that he didn't have help moving the bodies. The fact that the killer moved his victims' bodies at all is significant too. He clearly wanted uninterrupted time alone with his victims. Safarik explained that he believed the killer was a black male, simply from the fact that the first six people he killed were black. Statistically speaking, people are more likely to prey upon their own race, he says. Most violent crimes are intra-racial. The servant girl killer was also unlikely to just stop killing. Serial killers like him usually killed until they were stopped, either by being arrested or being killed themselves. But we know all this with the benefit of hindsight, and with the benefit of like a century and a half worth of criminologists studying such killers. 1885 did not want to admit that there was only one man responsible for all these crimes. The thought of a single monster causing so much mayhem was not just frightening to think of, it was embarrassing. Austin is in their golden days, and yet they cannot apprehend a single criminal who has put the whole state on edge. In their minds, it was more likely that these women were killed by their husbands or lovers in some sort of a domestic dispute. This, everyone was used to. Everyone was used to men beating up on their own women. What they were not used to was strangers doing the beating. So law enforcement went after the boyfriends and husbands of these women. At the beginning of the new year, Jimmy Phillips was arrested for the murder of his wife Eula, and 2 weeks after that, police arrested Moses Hancock for Susan's murder. Plenty of black men were rounded up off the streets and arrested for the other women who were killed, but as these were all black servant girls, law enforcement did not feel as pressured to apprehend the man who was actually responsible. With two white women murdered, law enforcement had to make an example out of someone. Unfortunately, the trial held for Eula's murder did not bring her any justice. In fact, it did her further harm. Now, not only had she been murdered, but society was also about to kill her reputation in court. Eula was 14 when she married Jimmy Phillips in 1883. J.R. Galloway wrote a book about the murders and speculated this was likely a type of arranged marriage, which took place just after her mother died. The newlyweds moved in with Jimmy's family as they could not yet afford a home of their own. She became pregnant in 1883 and had a little boy the following year. In January of 1885, they moved into a home belonging to Jimmy's dad's friend, George McCutcheon. In March, McCutcheon's wife died. Several months later, Eula again became pregnant. Eula's sister later testified that McCutcheon had procured abortion medicine for her and told the court that he swore to kill them both if they told anyone he did so. But author Galloway takes it a step further, stating that Eula had been pregnant with McCutcheon's child, and that was why he got her the abortion meds. By November, they were both back living at the Phillips household. It seems that the Phillipses had a rocky marriage. Jimmy was alleged to be a bad drunk and occasionally violent when he did so. Some say that Eula had left the home for some time because she was so upset at his drinking and bad behavior. Every now and then, Jimmy would swear to stop drinking and their relationship would improve, but then he would inevitably find his way back to the bottle. Towards the end of the year, Eula began visiting the home of May Tobin. Tobin operated a house of assignation. These were not brothels, but private homes that owners rented out to couples who were in need of privacy and couldn't be seen at a brothel or hotel. Well-to-do women like Eula would rent a room from Tobin and then meet their lovers there. Eula met with John Dickinson several times at Tobin's home. Dickinson was a prominent citizen, being secretary of the Capitol Commission, as in he was working on the massive state capitol building being built. At the trial for Eula's murder, May Tobin herself took the stand and stated that she saw Eula with three different men. Dickinson, Benjamin Baker, superintendent of the state's public schools, and William Shelley, who just so happened to be Jimmy Phillips' defense attorney. All three denied these claims, because of course they did, but the damage to their reputations was done. Also ruined was William Swain, the state's comptroller who was running for governor. His opponent, Sol Ross, decided it would be fun to spread rumors that Swain was the one Eula was sleeping with before she was murdered, in order to get a leg up in the race. Swain denied the rumors, but lost the election anyway. But what was more important was the evening Eula was killed, Christmas Eve. Tobin testified that though Eula had since moved back to the Phillips home, she had made a visit to Tobin's house of assignation that very night. She arrived at around 11, but Tobin told her that she did not have any available rooms and had to turn her away. Eula then got back into her carriage and went home. The prosecution argued that Jimmy Phillips discovered that his wife had been unfaithful to him and killed her. To cover up his crime, he arranged the murder to look like the recent attacks on the servant girls. They accused Moses Hancock with the same. Apparently, Susan's husband was also an alcoholic, and Susan was thinking of leaving him. A letter was uncovered in which Susan wrote to Moses telling him why she was leaving him and hoping that he would stop drinking. The prosecution theorized that Moses found out that Susan was going to leave and killed her first, and just like Jimmy Phillips, arranged the crime to make it look like it was the servant girl annihilator. So, two copycat killings on the same night? Austin officials were eager to catch the killers and put the whole thing behind them, but not everyone was buying it. Lawyer John Hancock was so enraged that the city was putting Moses Hancock on trial that he agreed to represent him for free. Ultimately, he was exonerated, but Jimmy Phillips was not, to everyone's surprise. The jury found him guilty and sentenced him to 7 years for uxoricide, or wife murder. Hell, they even had people testify to the fact that Jimmy couldn't possibly have hit himself in the back of the head the way that he was hit. The decision was later overturned and Jimmy went free, but two important things happened during the trial. The first being that they pulled out the bloody footprint found at the crime scenes and compared it to Jimmy's foot. His print was clearly smaller, but then someone said, well, if he was carrying Eula, then he would be heavier and his feet would be flattened out and thus larger. So they added some weight to Jimmy and took his print again. It was closer, but still not quite a fit. And if the foot don't fit, you must acquit. Just kidding, he was not acquitted, I just really wanted to use that line. But Phillips was released after his sentence was overturned, because his lawyers argued that he did not even know that his wife had been unfaithful to him in the first place. So he no longer had a motive to kill her. The second important thing to happen was the testimony of Travis County Sheriff Malcolm Hornsby. About a month after the Christmas Eve attacks, the sheriff was called to a saloon where a 20-something black man named Nathan Elgin was, quote, quite drunk and raising Hades in general. Elgin was arguing with a black woman and then suddenly knocked her to the ground and began dragging her to a nearby home. The sheriff got to him and put handcuffs on, but Elgin was able to strike him on the head. The sheriff fired at him, hitting him in the chest and killing him. Sheriff Hornsby noticed something unusual about Elgin. He was missing a pinky toe on his right foot. Sheriff took a plaster cast of his foot, and it was a good match for the bloody footprints left on the Phillips porch. The PBS documentary dove into Nathan Elgin's past to see what all they could find about him. They spoke a lot about locational expertise and the fact that whoever the killer was, he clearly knew the streets of Austin well. Each time he was able to flee the scene quickly, he always knew exactly where to go to avoid being seen. The killer had to be from the area or working in the area. Nathan Elgin had been a cook at Simon's, which was one of the city's nicest restaurants on Pecan Street and Congress Avenue, the heart of where the killings took place. Historians on the PBS documentary used a computer program to input the addresses where the women were attacked in order to determine where the killer likely lived, and the program agreed that the killer must be living or working along Congress Avenue, right where Elgin worked at Simon's Restaurant. Nathan Elgin was born in 1866, the fourth of five kids. By 1880, when he was 14, he was listed in the census as a servant, and the following year he was arrested for having a pistol on him when he got into an altercation outside of the governor's mansion. The year after that, he sent a letter to a deputy sheriff threatening to, quote, whip, destroy, and kill the officer on sight, end quote. And then he was killed by Sheriff Hornsby in 1886 after dragging a woman out of a saloon and across the street, just as the other women had been dragged to their deaths the past year. It was too soon for Austin police to know this yet, but the killings had stopped. Eula Phillips was the final victim of the servant girl annihilator. After Nathan Elgin was shot and killed, there were no more murders. Criminologists on the PBS documentary point out how Nathan Elgin had a past filled with childhood neglect, violent episodes and fantasies, and had expressed resentment towards authority. They argued he fit a disorganized, anger-retaliatory profile because the murders were unplanned and largely opportunistic. The victims were likely just in the wrong place at the wrong time, and it seemed as though he was just picking up weapons that were lying around the properties he attacked. The killer did little to cover up his crimes, and instead fled the scene quickly. Elgin clearly had locational expertise, working in the area, and he developed a signature killing style. He would select a sleeping woman to attack, knocking her out and anyone else in the way with a weapon before dragging the body away to another location. There, he would rape her and kill her. This alone time with a woman seems to have been what he was after, seeing as he merely incapacitated his other victims and only when he had to. The weapons varied, but the attacks were mostly the same. Axes, hatchets, and the mysterious rod that he used to lobotomize the women with. A screwdriver, perhaps? He had escalated over time, starting by assaulting but not murdering women, then by sneaking in on a lone sleeping woman. By September of 1885, he had gotten so cocky that he had progressed to surprising four fully grown adults when he killed Gracie and Orange in their cabin. By Christmas Eve, he had killed two white women. Was this by choice? Or did Elgin spot Eula Phillips leaving May Tobin's house of assignation and decide to follow her home and kill her? Tobin's house was, after all, right there on Congress Avenue, in the heart of where the criminologist said the killer likely came from. Regardless, all eight of the killings were similar in nature, and all killing stopped after Elgin's death. We can't say for sure, but in all likelihood, Nathan Elgin was the killer. There are just too many similarities, starting with the biggest one being his missing pinky toe. When I first read this, I thought it was so dumb. What kind of an idiot, knowing they are missing a toe or two, would take their shoes off before murdering someone and wading through their blood? Some theorized he removed his shoes to better sneak up on his victims, which does sort of make sense. Also, I don't think everyone even owned shoes at the time, although I would think that a man who was working in a high-end restaurant would be expected to wear shoes, but who knows? Maybe he worked in the back where no one saw him anyway. J.R. Galloway agrees that Elgin was probably the servant girl killer too. Elgin seemed to be the simplest solution, he said. He fit the profile and was the missing piece that seemed to fit the easiest. Not everyone wants to believe he was the killer, though, because some people want to believe the servant girl annihilator was none other than Jack the Ripper. In August of 1888, Mary Ann Polly Nichols was found dead, throat slashed and stabbed 37 times. She was the first victim of Jack the Ripper. The killings continued, and London Metropolitan Police did not really want to believe that an Englishman could be responsible for such atrocities. These sorts of crimes happened in America, in places like Texas, where servant girls were dragged from their homes and mutilated. Investigators caught wind that there were three cowboys still hanging around London from when Buffalo Bill had brought his Wild West show across the pond to England. Ultimately, the lead went nowhere, and Jack the Ripper clearly wasn't a cowboy, but the rumors of the Ripper coming from America stuck. Quite a few people like to say that Chicago's H.H. Holmes had been Jack the Ripper and started as the Austin servant girl annihilator, but Hollinsworth is quick to point out that Holmes had only been to Texas briefly after the murders occurred. Self-pronounced Ripperologist Shirley Harrison is convinced that Jack the Ripper was an English cotton merchant by the name of James Maybrick. He had been to an exposition in America in 1884 when the killings began. After living in Austin, Maybrick traveled back to London before the Ripper killings began. Hollinsworth said he spoke with the Ripperologist, and she admitted she actually didn't have much evidence other than the fact that the dates aligned and she really thought it was him. I don't buy that Jack the Ripper was the servant girl annihilator. Not everything has to be connected. In fact, it's like over-coincidence. Nor does it really make sense when you think about it. In Whitechapel, the Ripper's victims were slashed with a knife and left where they were, save for the random organ or so that he carried away with him, which was not the servant girl killer's MO. In Austin, the killer used various weapons, whatever was handy, and then dragged the bodies away to rape them. He did not make away with any of their organs. Also, in Texas, the killer had not sent letters to authorities taking responsibility for the murderers, as Jack did in London. Austin's servant girl killer murdered more women than Jack the Ripper, and did so years earlier. And yet Jack is the most famous murderer in the world, and the servant girl murderers have largely been forgotten. Why? Well, Hollinsworth says that Austin was still very much a backwater sort of place, particularly in the mind of Londoners. It just wasn't as well known or talked about. And then there is the fact that in Austin, the victims were mostly black, not white. I don't know, I'm bored of Jack the Ripper. He's been over-discussed. And personally, I think the 1885 Austin murders were far more fascinating. And they were significant. According to Hollinsworth, quote, Jim Crow policies came early to Austin because of the white residents' fear and distrust of the bad blacks, end quote. The city had always been segregated, but the segregation worsened over time, pushing African American residents to East Austin. While Austin had a black alderman in 1885, Albert Carrington, uncle of the victim Mary Ramey, it would not be until 1971 that another African American would be elected to office. The murders had stunted Austin's growth. People began to pack up and leave the city in the midst of the murder spree, and for some time after. The city had gotten a bad reputation as a place of blood and vice. The Criminal City, they called it. Others dubbed it Worse Than Babel, or The Dark and Bloody Ground. The servant girl killer, whoever he was, certainly left his mark on the state of Texas and on history in general. Many think of him as America's first serial killer, which is a highly fought-over title. It is a little ridiculous to call anyone the first serial killer because men have been killing other men en masse since the beginning of time. But regardless, as one reporter commented in 1885, quote, "He may well give to history a new story of crime," end quote. That's all for now, folks. If you enjoyed the episode, please be kind enough to leave us a review, and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss the next one. For more info and photos on this episode, check out our Instagram by searching for Old Blood Podcast. And same goes for our Patreon, which is a great way to support the podcast. Hint, hint. Look for the next episode in 3 weeks. Music credits to Facilian Studios, Holizna, and the original sung by Virginia Liston in 1926.